We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by Katie Faust. She is the founder of Them Before Us. Katie, you're also the director currently of Them Before Us, right?
I am. We are doing it all over here.
Apparently. Oh, my goodness. So Them Before Us is an extremely relevant group to the topic at hand now. We've had you on, of course, before, and you write for The Federalist, so our readers are familiar with your work and with your voice. I want to get into the organization itself a little bit and tell us what it's like. But I'll preface this entire conversation just by saying I'm probably one of the many people that has not thought too deeply about surrogacy, about IVF, about some very new reproductive technologies until recently. And the more I think about it, the more it does seem to be very much connected to this idea of overcoming our humanity through technology, which is something that we've always sort of sought to do. And we've done it in some really great and helpful ways, like washing machines, for instance. But that's not to say technology is always going to be the same as progress. And so I'm really eager to dive into this with you in particular, Katie. We're going to talk a little bit about a conversation that Dave Rubin had with Jordan Peterson. Dave Rubin was on this program not long ago, and we had a back and forth about surrogacy at that point. So Katie, tell us a little bit about your work at Them Before Us, which I love the name of. Tell us about the organization. Tell us about when you started it, why you started it, and what you all do now.
Yeah, well, originally I started just writing on my own about why marriage is a social justice issue for children, right? Children have a natural right to their mother and father. It is, you know, along the same veins of a child's natural right to life. These are both rights that are pre-government. These are rights that are self-evident, and they are rights that should be reflected in our law. And one of the least, the easiest ways to reinforce that right and honor that right is through insisting that men and women commit to the people that they are having sex with, right? So that any child that is born is going to be connected to both their mother and father. And so marriage is the only institution that unites the two people to whom children have a natural right. And so it kind of began with marriage. But then the more that I looked at other marriage and family issues, the more I realized that all of these different conversations obsessively focus on the desires of adults and what adults want, almost to the exclusion of what children need and have a right to. And we see that demonstrated very clearly in conversations about reproductive technologies, especially third-party reproductive technologies, where you are using a third party's sperm or egg or womb or some combination of the above. And really, I saw a lot of that evidenced in the conversation between Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin, where there was a lot about Dave Rubin's desires and his husband's desires for children and what they wanted, and their backstory and their longing and their thought process and their maturity and all of that. And in essence, kids just go along. And that happens in almost every conversation that we have, whether we're talking about divorce or we're talking about, you know, the monthly puff piece about open non-monogamy that the New York Times is running, or pushes to legalize polygamous unions, or promoting polyamory, or same-sex parenting. Like, think about it. Like, and I just, from now on, just listen to any conversation or headline or article that you read about any of these family structures, and just look at how it solely focuses on the desires of adults. So what we do at Them Before Us is we flip the script. We say, no, children have a right to be known and loved by their mother and father. And we're going to insist in the messages that we speak, the legislative letters that we send to different governing bodies, that adults conform to those rights. And that makes claims on all of us, single, married, gay, and straight, that no adult should force a child to sacrifice their right to their mother and father so that we can have something that we want. So that's kind of the big template. We take this, we say children have rights to their mother and father, all adults need to conform, and we take that into technological discussions, legal discussions, and cultural discussions.
Yeah, and you know, to the credit of Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin, I think the beauty of new media and people like them in new media is that they're willing to hash this out and talk about it so that we can actually really understand the perspective of a Dave Rubin in good faith, because there are so many people, and I know that you, I know that you have these conversations, these very difficult conversations. There's so many people, I think in Ruben's shoes, who want to be happy and want to be fulfilled, of course, and, you know, will love these children deeply, and the children will be beautiful. But there's clearly a conversation to be had about the ethics of this. And I wonder, Katie, how you approach those conversations. We can get into the argument itself, but when you're talking to people who have nothing but the best intentions, who have been told by all of our institutions that this is safe and ethical, and we've sort of organized our lives around individual fulfillment as a the worthy goal, as really the important goal, how do you go about making those arguments to people in that situation?
Well, he is just one of many adults that are in a situation where they really long for something. And like you said, oftentimes it's noble. You know, he is probably going to be a great dad. And my guess is his husband, David, will also be a great dad. But as they, to their credit, acknowledged, neither of them are going to be a mother. And they are just one of the many variety of adults who have something that they long for when it comes to their conception of a family, you know, that they desperately want. So the bright line at Them Before Us is we can empathize with that. We understand, you know, that I work a lot with couples that are struggling with infertility and challenges of, you know, just a husband and wife who desperately want a baby. When I'm not doing Them Before Us work, my husband's a pastor and we're counseling people who are in struggling marriages, people who are like, if I could just get out of this marriage, my life would be so much better. Yeah. And then multiple, you know, incredible single women who desperately want to be moms, but haven't found Mr. Right. I mean, do you understand that Dave and Dave are not special? They're not. At some point, every adult is going to have to make a decision of, am I going to honor my child's rights or my future children's right to be known and loved by both of their parent, or am I going to create a family around my own romantic or sexual desires or reproductive desires and insist that a child conform to that? So at Them Before Us, we have completely recognized that what we're talking about here is about as high stakes for adults as it can get. You know, the adults in the struggling marriage, the single woman that desperately wants to be a mother, the same-sex attracted adults would be incredible mothers or fathers. All of these adults have legitimate longings. But no adult longing justifies severing the child's natural right. And we already talk about this, and I feel like the pro-life world does this so well. They empathize with women in unplanned pregnancies that have had a devastating diagnosis, that feel like they are unprepared. And they say, we want to be there. We want to empathize. We want to support you. But no amount of your feelings justify violating a child's right to life. So we need to take that exact mentality into the conversations about family structure and marriage and reproductive technologies, because in both of these cases, someone's going to have to do the hard thing. Is it going to be the adult or is it going to be the child? Because it's going to be one or the other. And at Them Before Us, we say it should be the adults.
You know, then I'm not telling you anything, or I'm not asking you anything you haven't heard before, but the devil's advocate question is, you know, celebrities in particular, hold up these images, these videos, these lifestyles, they're beautiful children, and happiness is manifest. And the devil's advocate question is, what's so wrong with that? You know, what's so wrong with, you know, creating a child that you absolutely love? The child's life is better than not existing, than the child not existing, would be the devil's advocate position. How do you respond when people confront you with that?
Well, the reality is that 93% of babies created in laboratories don't ever end up existing. You guys have run some pieces. One of them was written by Katie Breckenridge, who works for Them Before Us, about why is it that big fertility is panicking right now? Why is it that fertility clinics in red states are saying, if we respect the right of children to life from the moment of conception, we can't do business here? That's because commodifying and destroying and selecting preborn life is critical to big fertility's business model. And while it's hard to get exact numbers because we don't require most of them to keep track of what they do with these preborn lives, what we know is probably about 7% of babies that are created in vitro, that are created in laboratories, will be born alive. Most of them are going to spend at least some or all of their lives in freezers. They will be thawed and discarded. They'll be donated to research. They'll be sex selected out or deemed genetically unacceptable and discarded. And if they are some of the few lucky ones that make the transfer to somebody's womb, especially in the cases of surrogacy, things like selective reduction, which is abortion, for the purpose of quality control or quantity control, is written into almost every surrogacy contract. So I rejoice at the babies that are born alive. They're beautiful. They're worthy of life. But so are the 93% that didn't make it. So this is not a child-friendly technology. And this is something that pro-lifers especially need to get straight through their head. That when you are talking about IVF and surrogacy, and then you throw in sperm and egg donation, you are really treating children as disposable and designer products. And that's exactly how the industry makes a profit.
I want to throw in another piece of bigger context that happened in the Senate judiciary hearing this week on abortion. So we're taping this on July 14th. And earlier this week, there was an exchange between one of the abortion advocates who testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, who said, picked by the Democrats to do so, she said, something to the extent of, my abortion is the best thing that I've ever done. It was an act of self-love. And that's really interesting, right? It sounds very gross, but if you... It is, of course. But if you think about it even deeper, it gets grosser. This idea that an act of self-love is the best thing you've ever done in your life. Let's just pause and think about that. And it speaks, Katie, to exactly what you're talking about, is that we have mainstreamed and normalized this mentality of self before everyone else, as self-fulfillment as the preeminent goal of a human's life. And fulfillment in and of itself is happiness. It's materialist happiness. It's doing what makes you happy, doing what brings you joy. And if that's the best thing you've ever done in your life, that's a sad life.
Yeah. And, you know, them before us, we say, go, whatever, form whatever. I mean, I may not agree, but form whatever consensual relationships that you want, make the decisions you want to make. But we create a firewall around children, right? But once there's a kid involved, you bend to them. They don't bend to you. And what you just said there is a pretty good illustration, I would say, of the similarities between the baby taking industry in abortion and the baby making industry in big fertility. What do they have in common? Well, both of them determine a child's rights based on whether or not they are wanted, right? In abortion, if a child is unwanted, you can violate their right to life and force them out of existence. In big fertility, if a child is very wanted, you can violate their right to their mother and father and force them into existence, right? That in both of these places, the adults are determining whether or not a child is worthy of protection of their rights simply based on what adults want. And so we have got to reject both of them. Children are not commodities. They are not objects of rights. They are subjects of rights. Children have rights. And because they are the smallest and most vulnerable among us, they especially need special protection, and we need to single them out, really, for legislation, and we need this cultural conversation to recognize that they're extremely vulnerable in both of these child commodifying industries.
All right, so think about this. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than we do in our cars or in our beds. And that's why it's so important to invest in the right chair so that you spend those hours with the right level of support and the right level of comfort, and then you get the most productivity out of your day too. X Chair has made my time at my desk not only more productive, but it's honestly one of my favorite places to sit for any reason. In fact, I'm sitting in it right now. Not only does X Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar, or DVL, offer the ultimate customized support, but my X Chair can even give me a massage, or heat up, or cool down. And now, thanks to X Chair's new FS360 armrests, I can even adjust my armrests to the perfect position. It is truly an incredible chair. All these unique X Chair features help the hours at my desk fly by in complete comfort. That's why I love my X Chair. Again, I'm sitting in it right now. Go to xchairfederalist.com now. That's the letter X, Fedderalist, FedderalistChair.com, or call 1-844-4XCHAIR for $100 off your order. XChair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. XChairFederalist.com. When, this is going to sound like a little bit of a pivot, but it's not. Here we are. When the new Roseanne reboot came out and did gangbuster ratings, like set a record because people were so hungry for something a little bit heterodox on, especially in comedy, but in primetime television, one of the wedge issues that the family fought over, people forget, was actually surrogacy in the first episode of the premiere of the reboot. And it's interesting because it touches so many people around the country, but the media has sort of decided that this debate is over, which is fascinating. And I want to ask Katie about some of the things people might not know in the industry, because it is very much presented by the medical establishment, by the media establishment, even by the political establishment, I would say, as a completed argument, as an argument that has been settled. This is a settled debate. It's settled science. But are there things that come to your mind that are totally like things people might not realize that happens in this process? And I know there are different processes and paths for everyone, but just in general, are there things people really don't understand?
Yeah, and there are, first of all, because a lot of, but this is a Wild West, it's largely unregulated. And so women who do things like donate their eggs or serve as surrogates, a lot of times they can't even consent to what kind of risks they're undertaking because it hasn't been studied, it hasn't been tracked. So there's a lot that we don't know that's out there. So to say that any of it is settled is just the promotion of adult desires, honestly, for the sake of the bottom line, because this is one of the most lucrative arms of the medical industry because it's almost all elective. But what we do at Them Before Us is we say, adults, you figure out what you wanna do. Just don't infringe on the rights of children. So let me talk about some of this from the child's perspective, because to me, that is really what we're talking about here. The adults can consent to selling their egg or donating their sperm. And I say donating because there are no nonprofits in this world of big fertility. Everybody is buying and selling and renting. And, you know, they talked about that a little bit between Dave Rubin and Jordan Peterson, you know, that Dave Rubin was saying, well, these women really, really want to help you have a family. And I'm like, well, that's interesting because there's not a lot of multimillionaires or celebrity women who are offering their bodies to be surrogates. It does tend to be more economically vulnerable women who do it. So the very, very clearly economic motivations for some of this. But
and can I just a quick point on that, because you brought to my attention that Rubin and Peterson had this back and forth about breast milk and research that shows the importance of breast milk. And Rubin replies to Peterson, I have two freezers in my garage, two industrial freezers full of breast milk. And that's such an interesting example of how upper class people, upper middle class people, and Rubin, of course, acknowledges his like economic privilege in this situation because he is in total good faith. But that's how another way that economically disenfranchised people and children are hurt worse by these practices, because there's inequity in after the birth.
Absolutely. So one of the number one problem with third party reproduction is a child is always losing their mother or father. Always, right? Whether it's their birth mother, their genetic mother, or their genetic father, you are forcing a child to sacrifice a relationship with someone to whom they have a natural right. Somebody who not only is going to give them the maternal love or paternal love that maximizes child development, because as they did a great job of illustrating in that interview, mothers and fathers offer distinct and complementary benefits to children. But they also offer something to children that they crave, and that is biological identity. And so we talk a lot, you know, I wrote a book about this, came out last year, and we have a chapter on the importance of biology in the parent-child relationship. And Jordan Peterson got it exactly right, where he said, one of the critical aspects of biology is safety. Children who are raised by their biological mother and father statistically are the most likely to be safe and loved. Conversely, children who are raised with an unrelated adult, especially an unrelated man, are statistically at the greatest, they're at the greatest likelihood of being abused and neglected. That biology confers some level of protectiveness for children. And so And then let me just circle back on what you said about, oh, these children are so wanted and they wouldn't be alive without these technologies, right? And so donor-conceived people, people who are created through sperm and egg donation, have been organizing, speaking up, speaking out, doing surveys, conducting internal surveys, publishing their stories. And they get that a lot. You know, well, you wouldn't be alive without the, well, would you rather be dead, right? I mean, people will tell them that. And they'll say, rape victims can be critical about the circumstances of their conception and still be grateful to be alive. And that's exactly how they feel. About 50% of them say, it concerns me that money changed hands. A larger percentage say, I struggle with feelings of connection and attachment to my social parent. Many of them struggle with more household instability because that biological connection does confer some level of cohesiveness within the family. They are disproportionately more likely to struggle with substances and delinquency. And so there is something about this biological connection. And what fascinates me, so this is the other thing where you can see the adult-centric mindset really play itself out in that interview. Dave and David talk about why they wanted a genetic child and that for some reason, it was really, really important for them to have a genetic and biological connection with their baby, with their babies, right? In fact, it was so important that they each get one. Dave Rubin wanted a genetic connection with a baby, and David Janet wanted a connection with a baby. And they wanted to see themselves in their own children. And then Jordan Peterson talks about how incredible it is that even with your newborn, you're like, that looks like my father, that there's something beautiful and precious. And to them, they go unexplainable about this lovely heritage that happens only through the genetic link. And so we can all agree with that, right? Like, especially those of us who are parents, we're like, of course, that makes so much sense. But it stuns me that they don't consider that that biological connection may also matter to the child. Here they are talking about how important it is for them to see themselves reflected in their children. Their children will not be able to see themselves reflected in their own biological mother. They have literally, intentionally, and commercially decided that their child cannot have access to 50% of their biological heritage. And that probably is the number one issue that children created through sperm and egg donation have, is this identity struggles. Who am I? I don't know who my father is. Many of them would say, that's not a donor. That's my biological father. Many of them would say, I struggle with what sociologists call genealogical bewilderment. I look in the mirror and I can't see myself reflected. I mean, that's nice that you, Dave Rubin, can maybe see your mother, but there's a huge half of who I am that I can't see reflected in anyone. So when you look at it from the child's perspective, you start to see, well, it makes sense. The adults want a genetic connection. Why then would they disregard the importance of a genetic connection to the child? And it's because we have an adult-centric lens about all of these marriage, family, reproductive technology conversations. And if we are going to be concerned with the most vulnerable, we have to flip that. We have to start looking at this from the child's perspective.
All right, I know I've said this before, but I'll say it again. One of the reasons I'm in journalism is because I'm just relentlessly skeptical of absolutely everything, including those glowing MyPillow ads that we all see so much of. But my own skepticism personally was just gone immediately after trying MyPillow, which I really love. Did you know that MyPillow is also about more than just a fantastic pillow, though? Now MyPillow has given the same attention that they've given to those pillows I love so much to their new MyPillow Percale bed sheets. The sale of the year on those MyPillow Percale bed sheets is going on right now. The regular price for queen size sheets is $89.98, but now that's only $39.98 with your promo code. They're breathable, cool, and crisp. They're durable, built to last, machine washable for easy care, available in a variety of styles, colors, and sizes, and they also have a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. So go to MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429 for deep discounts on the MyPillow Percale bed sheets. Queen size regular for the price of $89.98 are now on sale for only $39.98. While there, you can take advantage of the buy one, get one sale on MyPillows, towels, and more. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429 today for the sale of the year on MyPillow Percale bed sheets. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. And it is hard. And I know you do a lot of work on adoption issues too. And the big difference there is that this is intentional. This is intentional and commercial, as you say. It is sort of like a total flipping of the script that's required. And I like that you talk about it as a human rights issue, because that's what I'm curious about. When you talk to, you say, people who have organized and who are donor conceived and are sharing their stories and trying to talk to the media and trying to be advocates. Have you noticed that this issue is political? Because for me, when you frame it more broadly, you sort of broaden the aperture and talk about this from a very human perspective, pro-human, not transhuman or anti-human perspective, it shouldn't be political. And I imagine donor-conceived people fall on all different sort of ends of the spectrums. Is that the case? I mean, how have politics, I guess, sort of overlapped with their activism?
Well, I think the challenge is that this is very much tied up in the LGBT March for Equality, and that the right to marriage is completely linked to the right to parenthood. And it's so fascinating because in Obergefell, many advocates for gay marriage made the case that marriage had nothing to do with kids. And yet 2 years later in Pavon, the Supreme Court upheld this case from Arkansas that said, no, if you're married, if two women are married, then two women have the right to put both of their names on a child's birth certificate. So marriage and parenthood have always been wed. And that's just something that all of us, even you could even hear it, right? Jordan Peterson absolutely acknowledged that in the interview that, look, from a societal perspective, marriage is not about finding your soulmate. Marriage is about creating and nurturing the next generation. And even Dave Rubin said that. He's like, what am I even married for if I'm not gonna have kids, right? Both of these things go together. So when you're talking about opposing sperm and egg donation, which we should oppose it for everyone, single, married, gay, and straight. It doesn't matter who is using somebody else's sperm or egg or womb. You are always insisting that a child lose a relationship with someone to whom they have a natural right. And in the case of a birth mother, somebody that sets off, kicks off their life of healthy bonding and attachment. And so that's really where the politics come into play, is many of the donor conceived children will say, I have a right to my biological identity. I have a right to my medical history. It's hard for me when I'm on 23andMe and I suddenly realize I have 22 half siblings that I didn't know about, and every month there's another one. But many of them will stop and say, but I'm not against same-sex parenting, right? And yet these days, that is the primary way that two men or two women choose to have a family. And so that's really where the rub is, because we now have this narrative that two adults of the same sex have a right to marry and therefore have a right to parenthood. But that means they must have a right to somebody else's baby because it can't come just from them. And so that's where the politics is. And what we see is that adult desires that are framed as rights cannot coexist with children's actual rights. Children's actual rights to life, children's actual right to their mother and father is always going to run afoul of adult desires at some point. And unfortunately, in our public, national, cultural discourse, we have framed many of those adult desires as rights. And the result is kids have to sacrifice their actual rights.
This has obviously become a sort of front of mind issue for a lot of activists on the pro-abortion side and on the anti-abortion side over the course of the last month or so after Roe fell in the Dobbs decision. And there's panic in the mainstream media, as you noted, Katie, coming from fertility and clinics and the industry in general, saying this is now on the table. This is going to be up in some of the legislation that's being debated in red states. And, you know, I'm so far from an expert on this topic, I wanted to ask you, first of all, is that actually happening? And secondly, should that be happening?
Well, it depends. When does life begin? Does life begin? And when it is a life, when is it worthy of protection? So I'm not the biggest pro-life expert on this, but it seems to me that a distinct, unique human being is created at the moment of conception. And that if we're commercializing and commodifying and disposing of and discarding embryonic life, that's a violation of human rights. And so I think
could you talk about what happens with embryos just briefly for people who aren't aware of how the process works?
Yeah, you make the baby in the petri dish. You let it develop a little while after 3 to 7 days. You determine which one is a good quality embryo. So people going through IVF, and even Ruben himself will say, well, we had some good embryos. And that means there's some bad embryos, right? And what do you do with the bad embryos? You discard them. And the crazy thing is that we've now studied some of those, what looks like kind of malformations, and seen that if left to develop, oftentimes those things correct themselves over time. And so you are not only discarding the bad embryos, but you are also discarding potential good embryos. But the very fact that we are grading human life in laboratories and then determining who gets to live and who gets to die, I think that's something that we really need to take a look at. And this is an area where pro-lifers need to figure it out really, really fast. Because I follow people like Lila Rose and Seth Gruber and Laura Claussen and some of these pro-life advocates who are waking up to the fact that the baby making industry does a lot of baby taking.
Mm-hmm.
And when they talk about that to their followers, there's an absolute revolt, right? No, this is just about babies. This is just about infertile couples who want to have children. My heart bleeds with them. But there is a lot of overlap in the mentality and in the child commodification and in the child extermination between these two industries. And so, yes, we need a holistic pro-life ethic that begins whether you are in the place of having an oops pregnancy or a desperately want pregnancy. Children are not commodities. Children do not exist for you. You exist for them, period. And so we have to, in my opinion, create a world technologically, culturally, and legally that recognizes and protects these fundamental children's rights, no matter what kind of adult is seeking to violate them.
Cancel culture is coming to your bank, and holding the wrong political views might soon leave you out in the cold. I'm Bill Walton. On the latest episode of The Bill Walton Show, Todd Zwicky, Paul Watkins, and I discuss what is already happening, how the Biden administration is already pursuing this agenda, and what we can do about it. This progressive culture offensive is relentless. It's coming for you, and you won't hear about this anywhere else. Follow The Bill Walton Show at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And I'm also curious on that note, I think we emailed a little bit back and forth about the Andy Cohen example. And Andy Cohen is somebody who I enjoy very much as a Bravo fan. But he said recently that, you know, he has frozen embryos. And someday, if his children aren't able to have children, maybe they could, quote, thaw them out and raise their siblings, or defrost, I think he said. They could defrost those embryos and raise their siblings. And the language was so callous that it caught my attention. But I don't think it was intentionally callous, because it was just honest. It was just saying what actually happens. And I'm curious, Katie, if you think people's increasing comfortability with this process is also going to sort of make others increasingly uncomfortable about it. The more casually we talk about what the reality, have you noticed that, you know, maybe some people are actually willing to dig into this more the more we even talk about it?
What tends to wake people up is hearing from the children themselves. Because we can massage this, shape it, promote it. I mean, even at the end of the Jordan Peterson, Dave Rubin interview, Peterson, after they acknowledge that there is an ideal, it's a man and a woman, even after going through the army of women needed to create these motherless children for Dave and David, you know, Peterson kind of concludes with, I think a lot of people are going to be sympathetic with your position. And that is what happens when you only hear from adults, when it's just about what the adults want and long for. What we need is more contact with the children who are being raised, the ones that were created through these commercial processes, the ones that were intentionally motherless or intentionally fatherless because of these cultural changes, legal changes, technological options that are out there now. And so I would just encourage you, you know, we've got dozens of stories of kids created through third-party reproduction, dozens of motherless and fatherless children profiled in our book. The whole point was just to let you hear their stories yourselves. That is what tends to change hearts and minds. As long as the conversation is focused on adults and their journey and how hard it's been for them and how much they want, then, Yeah. I mean, then you go, well, Andy Cohen, it makes so much sense. You needed these good embryos. But once you hear from the children who are like, okay, so what you're saying is I am now 25 years old. I have lived with mother hunger all my life, which is what children who don't have a mother experience. They gravitate towards and they long for adult human female love, right? From whatever woman is in their life. And then Andy's two children will probably have struggled with the genealogical bewilderment and identity struggles that are common for children created through third-party reproduction. And then they are now going to put those children into their own womb or rent the womb of somebody else, raise those kids, and then introduce them to their 75-year-old biological father. And these children are chronologically the same age, but were born 25 years apart. I mean, this is dystopic science fiction world stuff. And in essence, we're saying this is okay because this is what a rich man wanted. And now generations of children are going to have to deal with the fallout, not just his children, but the children's children. Right. And so, you know, we have these stories of women, you know, one woman named Ellie that we profile in the book who realized she was created through sperm donation as a 30-year-old, realized then that she had about 50 half siblings and that many of them probably lived in her area. And she was so grateful she didn't marry one of them. But now that means that her own children have hundreds of first and second cousins. And a lot of them probably don't even know that they are the children or the products of donor conception. Like what is going on right now is so dystopic. And you need to hear about this from the kids. Stop listening to the adults. Stop listening to the adults. This is a children's rights issue, regardless of how adults long and what they want and all of their desires. You are playing with the lives of kids, their physical, literal lives, but then also their life of thriving and their life of identity and their life of needing both a mother and a father to satisfy their craving and maximize their child development. We are asking children to shoulder lifelong loss because adults want something and that's an injustice.
There have been a couple of documentaries recently sort of pitched or marketed in the true crime lens or through the true crime or in the, I'll say in the true crime lane about case studies of doctors over the last couple of decades in recent years, as this has become more and more common, injecting their sperm into unbelievable amounts of women. And these documentaries have done fairly well. Like, a lot of people are talking about them and I've watched them. And I wonder if that stuff does start to induce a shift in the discussion, the more the reality sort of becomes manifest as people age and it just sort of smacks you right in the face and you can't escape it. And on that note, Katie, one of the big picture things that's so interesting to me is the idea of transhumanism. And I always say, like, I joke, I feel like Alex Jones 10 years ago when I talk about this, but it's so important because the more you look back at, for instance, second wave feminism, there's a really good quote that Alexandra DeSanctis and Ryan Anderson have in their new book out on the life issue about, it's from a second wave feminist talking about how women must overcome essentially womanhood in order to achieve equality. And it's that is the cornerstone of the pro-abortion movement, which has really become the cornerstone of the Democratic Party. And if your idea is that your body and your nature must be overcome in order to be equal, you are going to go into some really dangerous places. We've seen it happen with marriage. We've seen it happen with life and the abortion industry. And I think we're now seeing it play out with the trans industry, with Big Pharma's influence over so many young lives. This idea that to be happy, you have to overcome your humanity is so dangerous. And I wonder if you see this issue of us sort of making ourselves superhuman, but also sort of suprahuman, like we are transhuman in the sort of metaverse sense of, like, we don't need to work out. We don't need to, we'll eat efficiently, we'll just drink Soylent and sit on our couches. And, you know, like, we're going to some really dystopic places. We're already in some really dystopic places. And you don't have to be Alex Jones, certainly, to recognize how dangerous all of this is. I'm curious as to how you think this fits into that broader anti-human agenda.
Well, you have to reject biology. Right. You have to reject the importance of biology. You have to reject the importance of maleness and femaleness. You have to reject the reality that male and female make babies, and that those babies have a claim to the two adults responsible for their existence, and that those two adults are going to matter for their formation and development. And you're going to have to ignore the decades of research that says that maximum, optimal, thriving and flourishing will be found when those two adults united for life raise the child together. And that is something that's uncontested among sociologists on the left and the right. And where I think the most dangerous aspect of this rejection of the physical body is the rejection of the importance of biology in the parent-child relationship. And so it's so fascinating to me that Jordan Peterson in that conversation observes that it's the one place that government doesn't really go is in licensing parenthood, and that this is something that is just, he acknowledges, right, it's a fundamental, self-evident, natural connection. And none of us would argue with that. Like all of the adults who have had a baby at a hospital, they don't want to leave the hospital with just any baby. They want the baby that was born to them, right? And that when the government wants to infringe on that relationship, I mean, why is it that we have armies of parents rising up now to protect their parental rights? It's because they're saying that baby belongs to me. And that's a really important biologically based relationship, right? And so Peterson says, the government doesn't regulate that. That's where the government needs to stay out. There's no licensing for parenthood, but we actually do. We actually do create licenses for parenthood after screening and vetting. And it is whenever an adult wants to claim a child that's not biologically theirs. And so I used to be the assistant director for the largest Chinese adoption agency in the world. I'm also an adoptive mom. We would rightly lose our license if we did not license parenthood to people who were seeking to bring a child into their home that is biologically somebody else's child. And yet, that's exactly what the third party reproductive world is doing. Is like, you can have two people, you know, Dave and David are going to leave the hospital with a newborn that is not related to them, like at least 50% unrelated to them. And many people who use these technologies leave with a completely unrelated child. On the same day, you'll have an adoptive couple leaving with a newborn. And yet this couple had to undergo months of screening, vetting, background checks, home studies, references, post-placement support, training, and these guys had to cut a check, right? And so actually we do license parenthood, but only when it takes place outside of the naturally protective bounds of biological relationship. And so it is a biology violating practice. Kids are going to be the ones that suffer as a result. And we have to get back to the place where we are embracing and recognizing the goodness of the body, the goodness of the male body and the female body, and especially the importance of those two bodies to the children that come from them.
Katie Faust, I always learn from you, director, founder of Them Before Us. Thank you so much for your time. Where can people learn more about Them Before Us?
Thembeforeus.com, the book. The book will make you a warrior. It will make you a warrior. You know, we're going to give you more than 100 stories of kids who are raised in these modern families and the ways that they suffered because adult desire was prioritized above their rights. And it's all of the best research, because the good news about embracing biological reality is legitimate research is always going to reinforce your perspective. So we are on the right side of history, because when you're on the right side of kids, you're never on the wrong side of history. So the book is a great resource for anyone that has questions about same-sex parenting, sperm and egg donation, surrogacy, adoption, the importance of biology in parenthood. But if you just want to get on and start fighting for kids, then just come to thembeforeus.com.
Thembeforeus.com. It's really eye-opening stuff. I can't recommend it enough. Go check out the book for sure. Katie, thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Drashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.